Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Daisy Project, where I have meaningful conversations with bold entrepreneurs, leaders, and change makers. Today's episode is a little different. I actually want to share my story with you from when I hit completely rock bottom. This actually happened when I was 19 years old. And I want to share this story because I know a lot of people go through this, especially through this sort of quarter life crisis phase. And this is also the impetus that led me to start writing a book, which I'm almost finished. It's been well over the due date, but I've been writing this book called Quarter Life Crisis for the last couple of years. So when I was 19, I hit the complete rock bottom. And I felt like there was no climbing out. I'd lost complete hope. I became a different person that I couldn't recognize. I'm generally a very talkative person. That's why I'm doing a podcast. I like meeting people. I'm extroverted. I'm usually the optimist. So I'm always giving things a go. But at this time, I found that I just wanted to stay in my room. I didn't want to go anywhere. The things that normally excited me were not exciting me. And I also became very cynical of the world. And cynicism is this really interesting way, because I think for the longest time in my life, I always thought sometimes a healthy dose of cynicism is great, but sometimes it can just be being cynical is in some ways, I guess, the opposite to hope. And nowadays, I really focus on having hope and optimism as opposed to having this sort of seemingly intelligent cynicism that a lot of people hide behind to critique things and to look for errors. So at this time, I was feeling very cynical. Nothing made sense in terms of what impetus there was for me to feel this way. I just knew that I really couldn't see the positive outcome to how I felt in any way. And this went on for 2 months. I tried to read books. I remember picking up Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now. And I remember reading that thinking this, I mean, it's a great book, don't get me wrong, but I remember reading that thinking, you know, he talks about how important the present moment is, how we mustn't live in the past and the future, and the fact that, you know, sometimes living in the past is one of the causes of depression in terms of remembering things that used to be or the way or things that happened to you or playing victim, which I definitely was, and that living in the future of what's going to happen can cause anxiety, right? So I was reading through and he was saying, you know, the present moment is very powerful and have gratitude. But at that moment, I was just like, the present moment is the worst place and I can't see anything. So at the time, the book didn't work, wasn't working for me. And I started listening to Oprah talks. I started seeing a therapist, which was big for me at the time because I feel it's more normalized now. This is about 6 years ago. And then, you know, it's become more normalized. But at the time, being from like a South Asian background as well, you know, we don't see therapists. But so I went to see a therapist and that was somewhat helpful. But I was, again, so far gone that even by the end of all my sessions, I had about 10, I just 2 months in and I just, it was going in circles. Part of this, you know, some of what led to my feeling this way in hindsight, obviously, is like family, part of it was family situation. Part of it was really not knowing what I wanted. Part of it was my life-changing experience in having living in Bangkok just prior to that experience, which was an amazing, eye-opening, incredible experience that I'm so grateful for, but also very, very deeply challenging. And like, what it involved was I got really lucky in some senses, and I'd been accepted into a program to do a legal internship where I've volunteered at an asylum seeker center, and we helped urban refugees. But part of my role there involved listening almost a daily basis stories of torture from refugees who would tell me stories about, you know, their children being killed, them having to leave their partners, their wives and husbands back home and being separated from them only to be seeking a safer life, being persecuted by their governments and losing family members. And it was just really tough. And then they would break down and cry. And I was 19 years old and I had to sort of hold up this sort of, I can't start crying. I'm meant to be writing the testimony for their legal case to support them for their refugee status. And it was just, it was an incredible experience, but I realized how I'd always thought I was very, very thick-skinned, and it was there that I realized maybe I'm not as thick-skinned as I thought I was, because this in some ways it hit home, but in some ways I just thought I felt hopeless because I couldn't I could just never do enough. But in the same regard, that experience is actually, which I'll talk about in another episode, that experience is what led me to become interested in entrepreneurship, because we worked with a Sri Lankan community of women to teach them entrepreneurial skills. And I realized how that was some solution to, again, regaining dignity. But so after this experience, I came home. I'd been home for about 2 months and I plunged into this sort of state of despair. And at the time, my mom said to me, we need to go to India. There's a wedding coming up and you have to go. And I just thought, there's no way in this state I'm going anywhere. Nothing is cheering me up. Normally I'd love going to celebrations and festivities and dancing. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to this Indian wedding. And then she said, no, you have to go. It's your first cousin. It's her daughter. She's getting married. It won't be good if you're not there. And I thought, okay. And she eventually convinced me I had to go. And so I went along to the wedding and I remember being there and looking at the wedding. I'm on the whole flight there. I'm just sort of staring outside the window and just contemplating life and being like, well, what's the point of living? Why do I feel this way? Why don't I feel like I know what I'm doing? Where have I gone wrong? I'm not normal. But I remember getting to this wedding and, you know, I was watching all these people dance and have a good time. And I was so cynical. And I was like, God, why do Indian weddings, why are they the peak of someone's life? Like, what's the point of all this? Like, why are they so excited? And I was just being very cynical, and which is unlike me in the sense that I would normally get involved and dance, have a good time and enjoy myself. And I remember like the second day of the wedding, I was like, that's right, I'm out of here. So I had a bag that I took along with me, and I remember in this bag, like this, I had this number, and it was because a year earlier I'd taken this same bag to travel when I went to Queensland. And back then when I was 18 and I was in a perfect state of mind and in some ways, and I was like having a fun time partying in the Gold Coast, and I was there for like a family function, and I met this sort of distant relative of ours who was visiting the Gold Coast for this family function. And she said to me, and I didn't know her, I'd never met her before, and she said, have you ever considered being spiritual? Like, we'd had this sort of deep and meaningful conversation. She said, you look like someone who thinks a lot, and you look like someone who might benefit from spirituality. And I politely nodded my head and thought, yeah, but I thought, really not for me. I'd been an atheist for like since I was 14, I decided I was an atheist. I loved Richard Dawkins. I read The God Delusion. I thought, this all makes sense. I don't need religion. I don't need spirituality. And I just sort of decided that. And when she was saying this, I listened to her, and then I just, you know, went on my way and just, whatever. But she gave me, like, I think she gave me a number or something, or she gave me the details of this place I should go to in India. She said, you should go to this ashram in India and you should visit this lady. This lady is someone she's amazing. She's very spiritual. She has phenomenal energy, and you'd learn a lot from being at this ashrams in terms of deeper inner work, exploring the truth and peace of mind. And fast forward 1 year, I'm at this wedding. I'm miserable. I've decided I just can't stand being there anymore. I open my bag and I find this sort of number for this ashram, and I decide that I'm going to go to this ashram. So I call them up and I say, hey, I'm Daisy, and I'm, you know, they're like, who are you? And I was like, I'm so-and-so's niece. And she said, I should visit you guys. And they're like, okay, well, yeah, we know her. She's great. And, you know, a friend, you know, like if you're related to her, your family to us, you can come and visit. And then I said, how do I get there? And at this time I was in Chandigarh in Punjab. And then they sort of explained to me, like, isn't, you know, your family driver going to take you there in India? I guess a lot of people have someone to help with driving. And I thought, there's no way I'm telling my parents I'm going to this place. My parents was, you know, traveling alone in the middle of India. They wouldn't feel that it's safe in some ways for me. Also, if I told them I was taking the family driver, he would tell my family where he's taking me. So I said, can I take public transport or something? Because I just thought it would be safer to kind of take a bus where there's people rather than finding my own driver, which I had no idea how to do. This is pre-Uber and everything, of course. And then they tell me, okay, you can take a bus. It goes to here, and then it goes to this station, then you catch another bus, and, you know, that's how you get here. And I thought, great. So the next day I packed my bags, my backpack, and I made my way to the bus station. And the bus station was chaos. There were people screaming destinations everywhere. And I remember asking the first person, hey, like, I need to go here. How do I get there? And because it wasn't his destination, he just didn't bother. He's like, not me, don't know, go elsewhere. And then I asked someone else and they didn't know. And then someone said to me, oh, you've missed the bus to go to that one. You should come back tomorrow. And for some reason, I can be a very stubborn person and I was persistent. I was going today or I was not going. And then I said, is there any other way to get there? And he goes, not really. And then I heard someone yell out a destination that was kind of close to where I wanted to go. I quickly opened up my Google Maps. I'd seen the city on the map before. And I thought, oh, that's only like 40 minutes away from where I want to go. So I'll just catch a bus to there. And then I'll, when I get there, I'll just find a rickshaw or something 40 minutes away. Bad idea. I jump on this bus and I didn't know it wasn't a direct bus, meaning it would stop like every 10 minutes it stopped. It stopped for people who weren't even at a bus stop. It would drop them off anywhere. It would pick them up anywhere. It stopped for like a lunch break. It stopped on the way when it got closer to the Himalayas for elephants, because apparently it's a legitimate reason to stop, I learned. I mean, they can knock over buses in the Himalayas. So it stopped several times. By the time I get to this destination where it's 40 minutes away, it's like 8 p.m., and I remember sitting on this bus and staring out the window, and people have asked me in the past, like, weren't you scared? Where did you kind of find the courage to travel alone and this and that? And it's kind of a sad place, but I remember sitting on that bus just thinking, I was in such a bad place that my physical safety didn't really matter to me, because nothing could feel as bad as where I was mentally. And it's a really sad place to be. But I kind of want to acknowledge that, because I don't think I was just brave and bold that I jumped on this bus. And I think it was really coming from a place that this is my last resort. I'm going to go see this ashram. I've seen a therapist. It hasn't worked. I've read books. I've tried meditating. Nothing is working. And as I looked at ashrams, and I learned that it wasn't really the spiritual side that drew me, but more so that people come to these places to meditate, to reflect, to learn how to regain control over their minds. And that was what appealed to me. So I got off at this stop, and then it's pitch black, because it's like, by this stage it was 8 or 9 p.m. And I was met, the people at the ashram did say, make sure you arrive before dark, which I clearly didn't, because I just took a different bus, obviously. And then I was a bit lost at this bus stop. I didn't know. And this lovely young guy, he was about probably like 9, 10 years old, and I could speak some broken Hindi, and he goes to me in Hindi, grabs my hand, and he goes, you know, you probably need to stop looking so lost, because otherwise you would just get kidnapped. And I thought, I'm not lost. And I was just like walking around in circles. I was very lost. But bless him. I told him where I want to go, and he goes, the buses are all gone. You're not going to make it. And I was like, okay, I'll grab a taxi. I'll grab a rickshaw. He goes, rickshaws and taxis don't go there after dark. There's elephants. You need to get on the last bus. And I was like, oh, crap. And he goes, look, you might be lucky. There might still be the last bus. He like grabs my hand. We run across the station, and luckily we get there. And like, thank God there was a bus to this last destination I needed to go. And so I jump on this bus, and it goes for another hour-ish. And I finally get to the bus stop at where I was heading to. And it's when I get there, it's, you know, a bus stop at nighttime in India, in some places, it's quite an eye opener. So I get there and I realize I definitely look different. People are looking at me. Maybe I should have worn like a suit or something, because I wasn't. It was kind of, I think it looked obvious that I wasn't from there. And it was mainly like lots of men. So I was starting to feel a bit unsafe. But luckily someone came from the ashram, had sent someone down at this point to pick me up, to go up into the mountains, because this place was further from the city in the Himalayas. You had to go further into the Himalayas. And this person who picks me up is this complete stranger, this old sort of man, and I don't know him. And at this stage, I'm thinking, I've kind of just jumped into a car with someone I don't know. Obviously, my distant aunt had told me to go check out this place, which I later work out that she's actually never been there herself. She just knows of one lady who's living up in the mountains. So anyway, so I'm in this car, and we go and we drive another roughly, I think it was about half an hour, into the mountains. And he's sort of scolding me, saying, you shouldn't have come this late. It's not safe. And he's Punjabi. So he's asking me all these questions about my family, and are my family Sikh or Hindu? And and I'm just trying to answer them, but I'm exhausted. And we finally get there, and like this car sort of comes to an abrupt stop, and we get out, And I'm expecting some like big sign, like welcome to the ashram, and you know, like something to do with yoga and meditation and I don't know, green juice or something. And there's nothing. It is pitch black. And there's this like, there's this, not a footpath, but this gravel-ish dirt slim pathway into the mountains. And as I look up, I see no lights. I see nothing. And he's like, right, we're here. And I thought, okay, I'm like, at this stage, I started getting a bit concerned. And then he puts this, my phone's dead. My phone's like gave way long ago. And he puts this sort of torch on his head and he's like, let's go. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to follow him up into the mountain. So I did that. We start walking. We walk about 200 meters, 300 meters. It's exhausting because it's uphill. And we get to about 500 meters and I still see no light ahead of me. And I think, oh God, there's no sign. Where he parked the car was like hanging off the edge of the cliff. There's only one spot. It's not a parking spot. It's just like this edge of the cliff and these roads around the Himalayas are very windy and small. So it just looked very unusual to me. And I keep walking up. I start having very negative thoughts. And then finally, when we get to roughly, I think it was about 800-900 meters, I start to see some lights and I was like, oh, thank God, there's actually something up there, which is great. And I arrive at this place and it's dark and I meet this lady who my auntie had told me to go meet. And so she's got a fascinating story. She's originally from Canada. She moved to the Himalayas. She was studying psychology at university and she felt that she wanted to find truth and she wanted to find what it meant to live contentment and to be live a content life and to be spiritual. And she decided to sort of quit uni. And she head off to the Himalayas in pursuit of like her guru to teach her the path to enlightenment. And she did this when she was, not, I think, 18 or 19. And she also had lived in like, I think she was born in or had lived in Kazakhstan. So she spoke fluent Russian. She'd visited Russia for a while. She'd also living in the Himalayas at this time when I went there, when I was 19, she was 30 from memory or late 20s. And she'd been living there for about 8-9 years. And I meet her and all of a sudden I'm kind of struck by how much of a calming presence she has. And then she says to me, you know, very politely, she's like, oh, you've arrived. It's dark. And I said, I'm sorry. I caught the wrong bus. And she goes, that's all right. Let's put your stuff down, but let's go meet the Guruji first. And I know nothing about gurus. I know nothing about Hinduism at this stage. And I just thought, you know, a guru is someone who gives you some sort of directions. My family had a Sikh. And in Sikhism, there are no living gurus anymore. There are the Guru Granth Sahib, which is our equivalent to our Bible, is the last sacred text with knowledge in it. If anything, Sikhism in some ways interpreted to condemn living gurus or any rituals. So for me, I had this apprehension about a living guru, but like it was more about he's someone who'd created this ashram in this space and I respected that. So I followed her in. We went to see the guru and he's sitting there and I kind of meet him and he looks at me and he says, and there's a bunch of people sitting there meditating around him. And this is like the most peculiar environment I've been in. And he says to me, you know, what brings you here? And I just said to him, I want to learn to meditate. I've learned meditation helps you with your mind. And I really feel like I've lost control over its thoughts and it's doing its own thing. And I'm not in a good place. And he sort of just looked at me and said, okay. And he just sort of tapped my head and that's it. And then the lady who I was there to see, she said to me, I'll show you your room. And I thought, that's it? I really thought he was going to give me some sort of wise lecture or something like that. But that was all. And then she walked me to my room and she opens a door and it's this very basic cement floor, cement room with a mattress on the floor. And it's freezing cold. This is like late November and this is like it's getting close to the middle of winter up in the mountains. So it's freezing cold. There's no heating. And she says to me, you know, you can wake up tomorrow if you'd like. There'll be puja at 6 a.m. I didn't know what puja was, so I asked her and it's kind of like a Hindu chanting. And she goes, and then there'll be Aarti at 7, but, you know, you have to make sure you have a bath before you come. And I'm thinking, all right, that means I have to wake up at 5:30. So I get into this room, I lie down on my mattress, and I'm staring at the ceiling, and I see this huge huntsman, and I freaking hate huntsmen. So I jump up, I run out of the room, and I think, what am I going to do? There's a huge huntsman spider. And then I just thought, there's no one around. Everyone's gone back to their rooms. I don't even know what room she's staying in. There's no such reception or anything. This place isn't somewhere. They've taken the signs down for a reason. They don't actually let anyone just come and stay. So it is, I'll be honest, a bit culty. And then so I thought, okay, I'm just going to have to go back in the room. So I crawl back in, sort of shaking because I'm so scared of this spider. And I jump into the back into my I was about to say rajai, back into my kambal rajai, what do you call it, a blanket, sorry, in English. And I lie down and I just pretend the spider's not there. And I know huntsmen don't really move very much. And I'm just kind of in my head and thinking, I hope in the morning it's in the same spot because otherwise it could be in this blanket. So I lie down and it takes a while and a lot of thoughts are running through my head. What am I doing? I haven't told anyone where I am. I think I told a friend, but no family members because they'd think I'd lost my mind, which I had. And I thought, I'm in the middle of the Himalayas. I'm at an ashram. I'm not even Hindu. I don't even know what an ashram does, and I'm here to learn to meditate, and it doesn't really look like they teach meditation. I should really go back home, or I've really lost the plot. And part of me was thinking, this better damn work, which was that conviction, I think, in this better damn work, and I'm willing to give it a go, which actually led to a really interesting life-changing experience. So I go to sleep, and then the next day I wake up early in the morning and I realize that this place doesn't have any hot water. So I go and boil like a kettle of water, and they called me a princess there at the time, and I boil a kettle of water, and then I boil another kettle of water, and then I pour it in a bucket, and there's no shower. And by bath, I don't mean a spa. I mean a bucket bath in a little cement, another tiny little cement room. And I at like five o'clock in the morning, I'm heating up this water, having this bath and going to Pooja, which I don't know what it is. And then I make my way to where they do the Pooja, and I sit there for 15 minutes, and it was really interesting. The first time it didn't make a lot of sense to me. I didn't understand the meaning, but I sat there through the chanting, but there was something very calming about it. There was something about listening to this that had this really calming presence. And so Pooja lasts about 15 minutes, and then Aarti goes on for about 40 minutes after that. And it was, I go through a lot more detail in what happens in the Quarter Life Crisis book that I'm writing. So I want to keep today's episode under 30 minutes, which I'm trying to do. So I'm not going to go into too much further detail, but it was being at this place day in, day out, doing Pooja, doing Aarti. I eventually worked my way up to meditating between 2 to 6 hours a day, not in one sitting, but like each day. And I do want to share the experience of the very first meditation to explain how hard it was. The next day, the lady said to me, okay, we're going to go meditate in my duni. And this duni was like a mud hut. And so she took me into duni. I think it was just me and her from memory. And she looks around, she goes, isn't this duni beautiful? Isn't it like a spaceship? And I thought, it's a mud hut. She's definitely lost the plot. And I'm nodding my head politely saying, yeah, it's beautiful. She goes, it's made of earth and it's just earth. And I thought, I'm pretty sure it's made of bathia, which is like cow shit or mud or something. But anyway, she sits down and then she says a few things. She sort of chants a mantra. And then after a minute, she kind of stops about, I think it's after 5 minutes. And then she's just sitting there with her eyes closed and she's got her like eyeballs rolled up into her head. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, after 5 minutes, I kind of peek open like an eye and I'm thinking, is she going to give me instructions? Is she going to tell me where the cushions are? Is she going to tell me where the toilets are? Like, you know, when you go to a yoga class or a meditation class, it's so cozy and, you know, get comfortable, find a cushion, get up anytime you'd like. And they give you guided meditation. This was nothing like that. She just sat down and didn't say a word. 10 minutes passed. I started to shuffle a little bit. I'm not used to sitting down with myself. I'm so used to having, you know, constantly being on the go and being productive or doing something or calling a friend or, you know, not really just being there with the goal of not really having any, working your way towards not having thoughts, and or just observing your thoughts until you eventually have less and less and less. And 20 minutes pass. At this time, I'm more swearing at her in my head in Punjabi, thinking, is she going to give me any instructions? Is this what you call meditation? I'm getting a bit agitated. I've come all this way and I have some level of entitlement to like be taught something. And then 30 minutes pass. And at this point, I'm very annoyed and my legs are gone numb. So I decide to just like get up and leave. I sit outside and like an hour later, she comes outside and I'm just sort of looking, enjoying the view, sitting in the sun, wondering, is this going to work? That was awful. She comes out and she asked me, so how was that? And I don't know if I should be honest to her, but I just thought, so I said, it was good, but I don't know how to meditate. Do you teach that here? And she goes to me, you're just going to learn that by being here. And then she goes, let's go down. It's lunchtime. We can eat now. And I thought, am I really going to learn that? And I ended up, long story short, I was going to stay at this place for like, just go and explore it for 3-4 days, check it out. I ended up extending my flights and almost staying at this place for 40 days in the end. There was something that compelled me to stay longer. And by the end of the 40 days, I was a completely, I had this complete transformation and I was able to meditate and I was overtaken by a sense of bliss and contentment that is so difficult to describe. And I've still got to say, in some ways, fast forward 6 years, I've been almost chasing that state, but having gone to that state and experienced that and experienced how to meditate and how to be and how, and we learned a lot about love and love versus attachment. We learned a lot about, I guess, how we're attached to possessions in the material world and how part of what we need to do is learn just how to be and to be content with just being. And that was one of the most profound experiences in the end, is not just, there's one thing of like taking in knowledge from books and lectures. And the example I like to draw is I guess one on love is, you can read as much as you want about love, but until you fall in love, you can't experience how powerful of a feeling it is and how all-consuming it can be for some people. And sometimes it changes you in some ways. So I guess for the longest time, the 2 months in the lead up, I'd been reading about meditation. I've been reading about, okay, spirituality, maybe this is something I should look at, about regaining control of your mind and bliss and contentment. And it was when I was there, I felt that I experienced that. And it was one of the most powerful, transformative, life-changing experiences. And it was when I left that place, I cried so much when I left that place. I don't usually cry, but I cried so much because I was terrified of going back to the real world in some ways after being there for like 40 days. And mind you, there's no phone reception. There's no, even an Indian SIM card doesn't work up there. So I just kind of spent all this time without a phone, just occasionally going down to the main town to eventually a week later, I let my parents know that I'm safe, I'm alive, kind of run away, but hey, and then promptly hanging up because they're like, come home. But I check my phone like about once every, I think it was about 10 days or 3 times. But that, I wanted to share that with you because that was, I guess, one of the impetuses of what led me to explore what it means to live a meaningful life, what it means to be content, what it means to be happy, especially in a time, in Australia, I guess where I live in Melbourne, one in two people will experience mental health issues in their lifetime, and one in four currently have a mental health issue in Australia. And we're all going around, so many people, and I was living in this state of like fear and anxiety and depression, concerned. And for me, that was the starting point of my sort of spiritual journey, but also my deeper journey of like self-knowledge and learning what it means to live a meaningful life, being reflective, increasing my sort of self-awareness of learning how to build conscious relationships and how to build, I guess, conscious businesses as well that give back to the world. How do we do that in a way that's fair? How do we do that in a way that makes our sort of, that lights our soul on fire in a way that we're living aligned with our values? So that's where it sort of started for me. So I hope that was interesting for you guys. And if you have any questions, I'm happy, like, just send them to me, maybe on Instagram. I'm Daisy Mahn. And I'm happy to answer them in the next episode.